Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Lovesang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, November 2016. Chapter 7. A cold, cold wind was blowing down off the mountains. Dust and small stones whipped through the air, and most of them seemed to aim directly for our shrinking bodies. Wise old animals stood with bowed head to the wind, that their fur should not be disturbed and cause them to lose body heat. We rounded the corner from the Kundu Ling and turned into the Mani Lakang. A sudden blast of air, even fiercer than the others, swept under the robes of one of my companions, and with a howl of fright he was blown up into the air like a kite. We looked up awestruck, with our mouths open. He appeared to be flying to the city, arms outstretched, robes billowing and making him into a giant's size. Then there came a lull, and he dropped like a stone into the Kaleng Chu. We rushed madly to the scene, fearing he would drown. As we reached the bank, he, Yulgi, seemed to be standing knee-deep in the water. The gale shrieked with renewed force, swirling Yulgi around and sweeping him backwards to our arms. Wonder of wonders, he was hardly wet, except from the knees down. We hastened away, holding our robes tightly to us, lest we too be blown into the air. Along the Mani Lakang we marched, and an easy march it was. The howling gale blew us along. Our only effort was to maintain a vertical position. In the village of Shou, a party of high-ranking ladies were seeking shelter. I always like to guess at the identity of the person behind the leather face mask. The younger the face painted on the leather, the older the woman who wore it. Tibet is a cruel and harsh country, with screaming winds blowing torrents of stones and sand from the mountains. Men and women often wore masks made of leather as protection from the storms. These masks, with slits for eyes and another slit through which one breathed, were invariably painted with a representation of the wearer's opinion of herself. "Let's go by the street of shops," yelled Timon, striving to make himself heard above the gale. "Waste of time," screamed Yulgi. "They put up the shutters when there's a gale like this. All their stock would be blown away otherwise." We hurried on, going at more than twice our normal pace. Crossing by the turquoise bridge, we had to hold on to each other. The force of the wind was so great. Looking back, we saw that the Patala and Iron Mountain were obscured by a black, sullen cloud, a cloud composed of dust particles and small stones worn and torn from the eternal Himalayas. Hurrying on, knowing that the black cloud would overtake us if we were laggardly, we passed the house of Doring, just outside the inner circle around the immense Jokang. With a roar, the storm was upon us, beating at our unprotected heads and faces. Timon instinctively raised his hands to protect his eyes. The wind gripped his robe and raised it high over his head, leaving him as bare as a peeled banana, just before the cathedral of Lhasa. Stones and twigs came howling down the street towards us, bruising our legs and at times drawing blood. The sky became blacker, as dark as night. Hustling Timon before us, struggling with the flapping robe which swirled around his head, we staggered into the sanctuary of the holy place. Inside was peace, profound peace, soothing peace. Here, for some 1,300 years, had come the devout to worship. Even the fabric of the building exuded sanctity. The stone floor was ribbed and grooved by the passage of generation after generation of pilgrims. The air felt alive. So much incense had been burned here throughout the ages that it seemed to have endowed the place with the sentient life of its own. Age-blackened pillars and beams loomed through the perpetual dusk. The dull glitter of gold reflecting the light of the gloom. The little flickering flames turned the shadows of the sacred figures into a grotesque dance on the temple walls. God cavorted with goddess in a never-ending play of light and shadow as the endless procession of devout pilgrims moved past the lamps. Pinpoints of light of all colors shot forth from the great heaps of jewels. Diamonds, topaz, beryl, rubies, and even jade flashed forth the light of their nature, forming an ever-changing pattern, a kaleidoscope of color. Great openwork iron nets with links just too small to permit the passage of a hand, guarded the gems and gold from those whose cupidity overcame their rectitude. Here and there, in the brilliant dusk behind the iron curtain, many red eyes gleamed, proof that the temple cats were ever on the alert. Incorruptible, unbribable, without fear of man or beast, they padded silently on velvet paws, but those soft feet held sheathed claws of razor sharpness should their ire be roused. A surpassing intelligence, they had to but look at one to know one's intentions. A suspicious move towards the jewels they guarded, and they would become devils incarnate. Working in pairs, one would flash at the throat of the would-be thief, while the other would cling to his right arm. Only death would lose their grip unless the attending monks came quickly. To me, or to others like me who loved them, the cats would roll and purr and permit us to play with the priceless gems. Play, but not take away. All black, with vivid blue eyes which glowed a blood red by reflected light, they were known in other countries as Siamese cats. Here, in cold Tibet, they were all black. In the tropics, I was told, they were all white. We wandered around, paying our respects to the golden images. Outside, the storm roared and fumed, blowing away all objects which were unsecured and making hazardous the passage of unwary travelers forced by urgent business to be upon the wind-swept roads. Here, though, in the temple, all was quiet save for the muted shush-shush of many feet as pilgrims did their circuits, and the incessant clack-clack of the ever-turning prayer wheels. But we did not hear them. Day after day, night after night, the wheels went round and round with their clack-clack, 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 until they had become a part of our existence. We heard them no more than we heard our heartbeats or our breath. But there was another sound, a harsh, rasping purr, purr, and the chink of the metal curtain as an old Tom butted his head against it to remind me that he and I were old friends. Idly I pushed my fingers through the link and scratched his head. Gently he bit my fingers in greeting, and then, with his rough old tongue, nearly scraped the skin off with the fervor of his licking. A suspicious movement further down the temple, and he was off like a flash in order to protect his property. "Wish we'd looked at the shops," whispered Timon. "Stupid," whispered Yulgi. "You know they're shut during the storms." "Be quiet, you boys," said a fierce proctor, stepping out of the shadows and aiming a blow which caught poor Timon off balance and sent him sprawling to the floor. A nearby monk looked disapprovingly at the scene and twirled his prayer wheel furiously. The great proctor, almost 7 feet tall, stood over us like a human mountain and hissed, "If you boys make another squeak, I'll tear you apart with my hands and toss the pieces to the dogs outside. Now be quiet." With a last scowl in our direction, he turned and vanished into the shadows. Carefully, afraid of even the rustle of his robes, Timon rose to his feet. We slipped off our sandals and tiptoed to the door. Outside, the storm was still raging. From the mountain pinnacles, pennants of dazzling white snow streamed about. From lower reaches, from the Patala and Chakpori, black streams of dust and stones flowed. Along the sacred way, great columns of dust raced into the city. The wind howled and screeched as if even the devils had gone crazy and were playing a mad cacophony without sense or reason. Holding on to each other, we crept southwards round the Jokang, seeking the shelter of an alcove at the back of the council hall. The torrent of turbulent air threatened to lift us from our feet and blow us over the wall into the Sang Kung Nunnery. We shivered at the mere thought and pressed on to the shelter. Our objective obtained, we leaned back, our breathing coming in great sobs from the efforts we had made. "Darn, darn, darn," said Timon. "I wish I could put a spell on that darn proctor. Your honorable guide could do it," Lob sang. "Perhaps you could persuade him to turn that darn thing into a pig," he added hopefully. I shook my head. "I am sure he would not," I replied, for the Lama Mingyar Donda never does ill to man or beast. Still, it would be nice to have the proctor turned into something else. He was a bully. The storm was abating. Less shrill was the keening of the wind around the eaves. Pebbles, previously windborne, dropped to the roads and clattered against rooftops. Nor did the dust penetrate our robes so much. Tibet is a high and exposed country. Winds piled up behind the mountain ranges and rushed in a fury through the passes, frequently flinging travelers to their deaths in the ravines. Gusts of wind roared through Lamassery corridors, sweeping them clean, blowing away dust and litter before emerging to scream through the valley and on to the open stretches beyond. The clamor and the tumult died. The last of the storm clouds raced across the sky, leaving the vast vault of heaven purple and pure. The harsh glare of the sun beat upon us and dazzled us with its brilliance after the murk and gloom of the storm. With grating creaks, doors were cautiously opened, heads appeared, and the damage of the day assessed. Poor old Mrs. Rax, near whose house we stood, had her front windows blown in and her rear windows blown out. In Tibet, windows are of thick oiled paper, oiled so that at some strain to the sight, see out. Glass is rare indeed in Lhasa. Paper made from the plentiful willow and rushes is cheap. We set out for home, Shakpuri, stopping whenever any item of interest attracted our gaze. "Lapsang," said Timon, "say, the shops will be open now. Come on, it won't take long." So saying, he turned off to the right at a much faster pace. Yalgi and I followed with just the merest show of reluctance. Arriving at the street of shops, we looked eagerly about us. What wonders there were! The all-pervading smell of tea, many types of incense from India and China, jewelry, and things from far-off Germany, which were so strange to us as to have no meaning. Further along, we came to a shop where sweets were sold, sticky things on sticks, cakes covered with white sugar or colored icing. We looked and longed. As poor cellists, we had no money, and so could buy nothing, but to look was free. Yalgi nudged my arm and whispered, "Lapsang, that big fellow, isn't that Sue who used to look after you?" I turned and stared in the direction where he pointed. Yes, it was Sue, all right. Sue, who had taught me so much, had been so very harsh to me. Instinctively, I stepped forward and smiled up at him. "Sue," I said, "I am..." He scowled at me and snarled, "Get away, you boys, don't pester an honest citizen about his master's business. You can't beg from me." He turned abruptly and strode away. I felt my eyes grow hot and feared that I was going to disgrace myself in front of my friends. No, I could not afford the luxury of tears. But Sue had ignored me, pretended not to know me. Sue, who had taught me from birth. I thought how he had tried to teach me to ride my pony, Nakim. How he had taught me to wrestle. Now he had repudiated me, spurned me. I hung my head and disconsolately scratched the dust with my foot. By me, my two companions stood silent, awkward, feeling as I felt, finding that they too had been slighted. A sudden movement attracted my attention. An elderly, bearded Indian wearing a turban walked slowly toward me. "Young sir," he said in his queerly accented Tibetan, "I saw all, but think not ill of that man. Some of us have forgotten our childhood. I have not. Come with me." He led the way to the shop at which we had so recently gazed. "Let these young men take their pick," he said to the shopkeeper. Shyly, each of us took one of those gorgeous sticky things and bowed gratefully to the Indian. "No, no," he exclaimed, "one is not enough. Take another each." We did so, and he paid the smiling shopkeeper. "Sir," I said fervently, "may the blessing of Buddha be with you and protect you. May your joys be many." He smiled benignly upon us, bowed slightly, and turned away to continue his business. Slowly we made our way home, slowly eating our sweets in order to make them last as long as possible. We had almost forgotten what such things tasted like. These tasted better than most because they had been given with such good feeling. I reflected, as we walked along, that first my father had ignored me upon the steps of the patala, and now Tsue had ignored me. Yalgi broke the silence. "It's a funny world," Lob sang. "Now we are boys, we are ignored and snubbed. When we are lamas, the blackheads will come running for our favor." In Tibet, the laity are referred to as blackheads because they have hair on their heads. Monks, of course, have shaven heads. That evening, at the service, I was very attentive. I determined to work hard so that I should become a lama as soon as possible. Then I would strive among those blackheads and spurn them when they sought my services. I was indeed so attentive that I attracted the attention of a proctor. He regarded me with high suspicion, thinking such devotion from me was wholly unnatural. As soon as the service ended, I hurried away to my quarters, as I knew I would have a busy day with the Lama Mingyur Dondup on the morrow. For some time I could not sleep. I tossed and turned and thought of the past and of the hardships I had undergone. In the morning, I arose and had my breakfast, and then was about to make my way to the Lama's quarters. As I was leaving the room, a hulking monk in a tattered robe grabbed me. "Hey, you," he said. You work in the kitchen this morning, cleaning millstones, too. But, sir, I replied, my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dandap, wants me. I attempted to squeeze past. No, you come with me. Doesn't matter who wants you. I say you're going to work in the kitchen. He grabbed my arm and twisted it so that I could not escape. Reluctantly, I went with him. There was no choice. In Tibet, we all took our turn at manual, or at menial, tasks. Teaches humility, said one. Prevents a boy from getting above himself, said another. Knocks out class distinctions, said a third. Boys and monks work at any task assigned purely as discipline. Of course, there was a domestic staff of lower grade monks, but boys and monks of all grades had to take turns at the lowest and most unpleasant tasks as training. We all hated it, as the regulars, inferior men all, treated us as slaves, well knowing that we could not possibly complain. Complain? It was meant to be hard. Down the stone corridor we went, down the steps made of two wooden uprights with bars fixed across, into the great kitchens where I had been so badly burned on the leg. There, said the monk who was holding me, get up and clean out the grooves in the stones. Picking up a sharp metal spike, I climbed onto one of the great barley grinding wheels and industriously dug into the crushed debris lodged in the grooves. This stone had been neglected, and now, instead of grinding, it had just spoiled the barley. My task was to dress the surface so that it was again sharp and clean. The monk stood by, idly picking his teeth. Hey! Yelled a voice from the entrance. Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa. Is Tuesday, Lobsang Rampa here? The Honorable Lama Mingyar Dandap wants him immediately. Instinctively, I stood up and jumped off the stone. Here I am, I called. The monk brought his bald fist hard down on the top of my head, knocking me to the ground. I say you'll stay here and do your work, he growled. If anyone wants you, let him come in person. Catching me by the neck, he lifted me and flung me onto the stone. My head struck a corner, and all the stars in the heavens flamed into my consciousness before fading and leaving the world blank and dark. Strangely, I had a sensation of being lifted horizontally, and then stood on my feet. Somewhere, a great deep-toiled gong seemed to be tolling out the seconds of life. It went bong, 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 and with the final stroke, I felt that I had been struck by blue lightning. On the instant, the world grew very bright, bright with a kind of yellowish light, a light in which I could see more clearly than normal. Ooh, I said to myself, so I'm outside of my body. Oh, I do look strange. I had had considerable experience of astral traveling. I had traveled far beyond the confines of this old earth of ours, and I had traveled also to many of the great cities upon this globe. Now, though, I had my first experience of being jumped out of my body. I stood beside the great millstone looking down with considerable distaste at the scruffy little figure in the very tattered robe lying on the stone. I gazed down, and it was only a matter of passing interest to observe how my astral body was joined to that battered figure by a bluish-white cord which undulated and pulsed, which glowed brightly and faded, and glowed and faded again. Then I gazed more closely at my body upon this stone slab, and was appalled at the great gash over the left temple, from whence oozed dark red blood, blood which seeped down into the stone grooves and mixed inextricably with the debris which so far had not been dug out. A sudden commotion attracted my attention, and as I turned, I saw my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dandap, entering the kitchen, his face white with anger. He strode forward and came to a halt right before the head monk of the kitchen, the monk who had treated me so badly. No word was spoken, no word at all. In fact, there was a hushed and deathly silence. My guide's piercing eyes seemed to strike lightning into the kitchen monk. With a sigh like a punctured balloon, he subsided into an inert mass on the stone floor. Without sparing a second glance at him, my guide turned away, turned to my earthly figure stretched out, breathing stertorously upon that stone circle. I looked about me. I was really fascinated to think that I was now able to get out of my body for short distances. Going far travels in the astral was nothing. I always had been able to do that, but this sensation of getting out of myself and looking down upon my earthly suit of clay was a new, intriguing experience. Ignoring the happenings about me for a moment, I let myself drift up through the ceiling of the kitchen. "Oh," I said involuntarily, as I passed through the stone ceiling into the room above. Here were seated a group of lamas in deep contemplation. I saw, with some interest, that they had a sort of model of the world before them. It was a round ball upon which were indicated continents and lands and oceans and seas, and the round ball was fixed at an angle, the angle corresponding to the tilt of the earth itself in space. I did not tarry there. This seemed to me to be too much like lesson work. I journeyed upwards, through another ceiling, through another and yet another, and then I stood in the room of the tombs. About me were the great golden walls which supported the tombs of the incarnations of the Dalai Lama for centuries past. I stood here in reverent contemplation for some moments, and then allowed myself to drift upwards, upwards, so that at last, below me, I saw the glorious patella, with all its gleaming gold, with all its scarlet and crimson, and with the wondrous white walls which seemed to melt into the living rock of the mountain itself. Turning my gaze slightly to the right, I could see the village of Sho, and beneath that, the city of Lhasa, with the blue mountains in the background. As I rose, I could see the limitless spaces of our fair and pleasant land, a land which could be hard and cruel through the vagaries of unpredictable weather, but which, to me, was home. A remarkably severe tugging attracted my attention, and I found myself being reeled in, as I often reeled in a kite which was soaring in the sky. I sank down and down, down into the patella, through the floors which became ceilings, and through floors again, until at last I reached my destination and stood again beside my body in the kitchen. The lama, Mingyar Dondup, was gently bathing my left temple, picking pieces from it. "Good gracious," I said to myself in profound astonishment, "is my head so thick that it cracked or chipped the stone?" Then I saw that I had a small fracture. I saw also a lot of the material being pulled from my head was debris, rubbish, the chippings of stone and remnants of ground barley. I watched with interest, and I confess, some amusement, for here, standing beside my body, in my astral body, I felt no pain, no discomfort, only peace. At last, the Lama Mingyar Dondup finished his ministrations, and he put a patch, a herbal compress, upon my head, and bound it about with silken bonds. Then, motioning to two monks who stood by with the litter, he instructed them to lift me so carefully. The men, monks of my own order, gently lifted me and placed me upon the litter, with the Lama Mingyar Dondup walking beside. I was carried off. I looked about me in considerable astonishment. The light was fading. Had I been so long that the day was dying? Before I had an answer to that, I found that I, too, was fading. The yellow and the blue of the spiritual light was diminishing in intensity, and I felt an absolutely overwhelming, absolutely overpowering urge to rest, to sleep, and not to bother about anything. I knew no more for a time, and then, through my head, shot excruciating pains, pains which caused me to see red and blue and green and yellow, pains which made me think that I should go mad with the intense agony. A cool hand was placed upon me, and a gentle voice said, "It is all right, Lobsang. It is all right. Rest. Rest and go to sleep." The world seemed to become a dark, fluffy pillow. The pillow was soft as swan's down, into which I sank gratefully, peacefully, and the pillow seemed to envelop me so that I knew no more. And again my soul soared in space, while upon the earth my battered body remained at rest. It must have been many hours later when I again regained consciousness. I awakened to find my guide sitting beside me, holding my hands in his. As my eyelids fluttered upwards and the light of the evening streamed in, I smiled weakly, and he smiled back at me then. Disengaging his hands, he took from a little table beside him a cup with some sweet-smelling brew. Gently pressing it to my lips, he said, "Drink this up. It will do you good." I drank, and life flooded through me once again, so much so that I tried to sit up. The effort was too much. I felt as if a great club had been bashed down once more upon my head. I saw vivid lights, constellations of lights, and I soon desisted in my efforts. The evening shadows lengthened. From below me came the muted sound of the conches, and I knew that the service was about to start. My guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, said, "I have to go for half an hour, Lobsang, because the Inmost One wants me, but your friends, Timon and Yulgi, are here to look after you in my absence, and to call upon me should the occasion arise." He squeezed my hands, rose to his feet, and left the room. Two familiar faces appeared, half frightened and wholly excited. They squatted down beside me, and Timon said, "Oh, Lobsang, did the kitchen master get a telling off about all this?" "Yes," said the other, "and he's being turned out of the lamasery for extreme, unnecessary brutality. He's being escorted out right now." They were bubbling with excitement, and then Timon said, "I thought you were dead, Lobsang. You really did bleed like a stuffed yak." I really had to smile as I looked at them. Their voices showed how thrilled they were at any excitement to relieve the drab monotony of life in a lamasery. I held no grudge against them for their excitement, knowing that I too would have been excited if the victim had been other than me. I smiled upon them and was then overpowered by an oppressive tiredness. I closed my eyes, intending to rest them for a few moments, and once again I knew no more. For several days, perhaps 7 or 8 in all, I rested upon my back, and my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, acted as my nurse. But for him I should not have survived, for life in a lamasery is not necessarily gentle or kind. It is indeed survival of the fittest. The Lama was a kind man, a loving man, but even had he been otherwise, there would have been the greatest reasons for keeping me alive. I, as I have said before, had a special task to do in life, and I suppose that the hardships that I was undergoing as a boy were meant in some way to toughen me up, to make me become immured to hardship and suffering, for all the prophecies that I had heard, and I had heard quite a few, had indicated that my life would be a life of sorrow, a life of suffering. But it was not all suffering. As my condition improved, there were more opportunities for talk with my guide. We talked of many things. We covered common subjects, and we covered subjects which were most uncommon. We dealt at length with various occult subjects. I remember on one occasion saying, "It must be a wonderful thing, Honorable Lama, to be a librarian and so possess all the knowledge in the world. I would be a librarian were it not for all these terrible prophecies as to my future." My guide smiled down upon me. "The Chinese have a saying, 'A picture is worth a thousand words,' Lobsang. But I say that no amount of reading nor looking at pictures will replace practical experience and knowledge." I looked at him to see if he were serious, and then I thought of the Japanese monk, Kenji Takuchi, who, for almost 70 years, had studied the printed word and failed to practice or to absorb anything that he had read. My guide read my thoughts. "Yes," he said, "the old man is not mental. He gave himself mental indigestion by reading everything and anything and not absorbing any of it. He imagines that he's a great man, a man of surpassing spirituality. Instead, he's a poor old blunderer who deceives no one so much as himself." The Lama sighed sadly and said, "He is spiritually bankrupt, knowing all but knowing nothing. The insensate, indiscriminate, and ill-advised reading of all that comes one's way is dangerous. This man followed all the great religions, and understanding none of them, he yet set himself up as the greatest spiritual man of all." "Honorable Lama," I said, "if it be so harmful to have books, why are there books?" My guide looked blankly at me for a moment. "Ha," I thought, "he doesn't know the answer to that one." Then he smiled again and said, "But my dear Lobsang, the answer is so obvious. Read, read and read again, but never let any book overpower your discrimination nor your discernment. A book is meant to teach, to instruct, or even to amuse. A book is not a master to be followed blindly and without reason. No person possessed of intelligence should ever be enslaved by a book or by the words of another." I sat back and nodded my head. "Yes, that made sense. But then, why bother with books?" "Books, Lobsang?" said my guide in answer to my query. "Of course there must be books. The libraries of the world contain most of the knowledge of the world. But no one but an idiot would say that mankind is the slave of books. Books exist merely to be a guide unto mankind, to be there for his reference, for his use. It is indeed a fact that books misused can be a curse, for they lead a man to feel that he is greater than he is, and thus to lead him to devious paths in life, paths which he has not the knowledge nor the wit to follow to the end. Well, honorable Lama, I asked again, what are the uses of books? My guide looked hard at me and said, you cannot go to all the places in the world and study under the greatest masters of the world, but the printed word, books, can bring their teachings to you. You do not have to believe everything you read, nor do the great masters of writing ever tell you that you should. You should use your own judgment and use their words of wisdom as a pointer to what should be your words of wisdom. I can assure you that a person who is not ready to study a subject can harm himself immeasurably by getting hold of a book and, as it were, trying to raise himself above his karmic station by studying the words and the works of others. It may well be that the reader is a man of low evolutionary development, and in that case, in studying the things which at the present are not for him, he may stunt rather than enhance his spiritual development. I have known many such cases, and our Japanese friend is just one. My guide rang for tea, a most necessary adjunct to all our discussions. When tea had been brought by the monk's servant, we again resumed our discussion. My guide said, Lobsang, you are going to have a most unusual life, and to that end your development is being forced. Your telepathic powers are being increased by any method at our disposal. I'm going to tell you now that in just a few months you're going to study by telepathy, allied to clairvoyance, some of the greatest books of the world, some of the literary masterpieces of the world, and you're going to study them irrespective of lack of knowledge of the language in which they're written. I'm afraid that I gaped at him in real astonishment. How could I study a book written in a language I didn't know? That was a matter which puzzled me, but I soon received an answer. When your powers of telepathy and clairvoyance are a little more acute, as they will be, you will be able to pick up the whole thoughts of a book from people who have just recently read the book, or are at present engaged upon such reading. This is one of the lesser known uses of telepathy, which, of course, must in such cases be allied to clairvoyance. People in other parts of the world cannot always get to a public library or to one of the leading library centers of a country. They may pass the door, but unless they can prove they're a genuine student in search of knowledge, they are not admitted. Such a bar will not be placed on you. You will be able to travel in the astral and study, and that will help you all the days of your life and to the time when you pass beyond this life. He told me of the uses of occultism, misuse of occult power, or the domination of another person by occult means, brought a truly terrible punishment. Esoteric powers, metaphysical powers, and extrasensory perceptions were to be used only for good, only in the service of others, only to increase the sum total of knowledge contained in the world. But, Honorable Lama, I said urgently, how about people who get out of their bodies with excitement or with interest? How about when they fall out of their bodies and then nearly die of fright? Can nothing be done to warn them? My guide smiled rather sadly at this, as he said, "It is true, Lob Sang, that many, many people read books and try experiments without having a suitable master at hand. Many people get out of themselves either through drink, or through overexcitement, or through overindulgence in something which is not good for the spirit, and then they panic. There is one way in which you can help. Throughout your life, you should warn those who inquire that the only thing to fear in occult matters is fear. Fear allows undesirable thoughts, undesirable entities to enter, and even to take control of one, to take possession of one, and you, Lob Sang, should repeat again and again that there is nothing ever to fear other than fear itself. In casting out fear, then, you strengthen humanity and make humanity purer. It is fear which causes wars, fear which makes dissension in the world, fear which turns man's hand against man. Fear and fear alone is the enemy, and if we throw out fear once and for all, then, believe me, there is nothing more than needs to be feared. Fear. What was all this talk about fear? I looked up at my guide, and I suppose he saw the unspoken question in my eyes. Perhaps instead he read my thoughts telepathically. Whatever it was, he suddenly said, "So, you are wondering about fear. Well, you are young and innocent." I thought to myself, "Oh, not so innocent as he thinks." The Lama smiled as if he enjoyed that private joke with me. Of course, I had not uttered a word. And then he said, "Fear is a very real thing, a tangible thing. You will have heard of tales of those who are addicted to spirits, who become intoxicated. They are men who see remarkable creatures. Some of these drunkards claim to see green elephants with pink stripes, or even more bizarre creatures. I tell you, Lob Sang, that the creatures which they see, so-called figments of their imagination, are real creatures indeed." I was still not clear about this matter of fear. Of course, I knew what fear was in the physical sense. I thought of the time when I had had to stay motionless outside the Chakpori Lamasery so that I could undergo the test of endurance before being permitted to enter and be accepted as the humblest of humble chelas. I turned to my guide and said, "Honorable Lama, what is all this fear? In conversation I have heard of the creatures of the lower astral, yet I myself, in all my astral travels, have never encountered nothing which caused me even a moment's fear. What is all this fear?" My guide sat still for a moment, then, as if reaching a sudden decision, he rose swiftly to his feet and said, "Come." I arose also, and we went along a stone corridor, turned to the right, and then to the left, and the right again. Continuing our journey, we at last turned into a room where there was no light. It was like stepping into a pool of blackness. My guide went first and lit a butter lamp which was standing ready beside the door. Then, motioning to me to lie down, he said, "You are old enough to experience the entities of the lower astral. I am prepared to assist you to see these creatures and to make sure that you come to no harm, for they should not be encountered unless one is adequately prepared and protected. I will extinguish this light, and you rest in peace and let yourself drift away from your body. Let yourself drift whether you will, regardless of destination, regardless of intention, just drift and wander as the breeze." So saying, he extinguished the lamp, and there was no glimmer of light in that place when he had shut the door. I could not even detect his breathing, but I could feel his warm, comforting presence near me. Astral traveling was no new experience to me. I was born with the ability to travel thus and to remember always everything. Now, stretched upon the ground, with my head resting upon part of my rolled-up robe, I folded my hands, put my feet together, and dwelt upon the process of leaving the body. The process which is so simple to those who know. Soon I felt the gentle jerk which indicates a separation of the astral vehicle from the physical, and with that jerk there came a flooding of light. I seemed to be floating at the end of my silver cord. Beneath me was utter blackness, the blackness of the room which I had just left, and in which there was no glimmer of light. I looked about me, but this was in no way different from the normal travels that I had undertaken before. I thought of elevating myself above the Iron Mountain, and with the thought I was no longer in that room, but hovering above the Iron Mountain, hovering 200, perhaps 300 feet, suddenly I was no longer aware of the Patala, no longer aware of the Iron Mountain, no longer aware of the land of Tibet nor of the Valley of Lhasa. I felt sick with apprehension. My silver cord trembled violently, and I was appalled to see that some of the silver-blue haze which always emanated from the cord had turned into a sickly yellow-green. Without warning, there was a terrible twitching, a terrible tugging, a sensation as if insane fiends were trying to reel me in. Instinctively, I looked down and nearly fainted at what I saw. About me, rather below me, were the strangest and most hideous creatures such as were seen by drunks. The most horrible thing I had ever seen in my life came undulating towards me. It looked like an immense slug with an ugly human face, but of such colors as no human ever wore. The face was red, but the nose and the ears were green, and the eyes seemed to revolve within their sockets. There were other creatures, too. Each seemed to be more horrible and more nauseating than the ones before. I saw creatures which no words could describe, yet they all seemed to have a common human trait of cruelty about them. They reached, they tried to pluck at me, they tried to tear me away from my cord. Others reached down and tried to separate the cord by pulling at it. I looked and shuddered, and then I thought, fear! So this is fear! While these things cannot hurt me, I am immune from their manifestations. I am immune from their attacks. And as I thought thus, the entities disappeared and were no more. The ethereal cord joining me to my physical body brightened and reverted to its normal colors. I felt exhilarated, free, and I knew that in undergoing and surmounting this test, I should not again be afraid of anything which could happen in the astral. It taught me conclusively that the things of what we are afraid cannot hurt us unless we permit them to hurt us through our fear. A sudden tugging at my silver cord attracted my attention again, and I looked down without the slightest hesitation, without the slightest sensation or feeling of fear. I saw a little glimmer of light. I saw that my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, had lighted that little flickering butter lamp, and my physical body was drawing down my astral body. Gently I floated down through the roof of the Chakpori, floated down so that I was horizontal above my physical body, and then gently, so very gently, I drifted down, and the astral and physical merged and were as one. The body, which was now I, twitched slightly, and I sat up. My guide looked down at me with a loving smile upon his face. "Well done, Lobsang. To let you in to a very, very great secret, you did better on your first attempt than I did on mine. I am proud of you." I was still quite puzzled about this fear business, so I said, "Honorable Lama, what is there to be afraid of, really?" My guide looked quite serious, even somber, as he said, "You have led a good life, Lobsang, and have nothing to fear, therefore you do not fear. But there are those who have committed crimes, who have done wrongs against others, and when they are alone, their conscience troubles them sorely. The creatures of the lower astral feed on fear. They are nourished by those of troubled conscience. People make thought forms of evil. Perhaps at some time in the future, you will be able to go into an old, old cathedral or temple that has stood for countless years. From the walls of that building, such as our own Jokang, you will sense the good that has occurred within that building. But then, if you can suddenly go to an old, old prison where much suffering, much persecution has taken place, then you will indeed have the opposite effect. It follows from this that the inhabitants of buildings make thought forms which inhabit the walls of the buildings. Therefore, it is apparent that a good building has good thought forms which give out good emanations, and the places of evil have evil thought forms within them. Wherefore, it is again clear that only evil thoughts can come from an evil building, and those thoughts and those thought forms can be seen and touched by those who are clairvoyant while in the astral state. My guide thought for a moment and then said, "There are cases, as you will be aware, when monks and others imagine that they are greater than their own reality. They build a thought form, and in time the thought form colors their whole outlook. There is a case, which I recall at this moment, where an old Burmese monk, a remarkably ignorant man too, I have to say, he was a lowly monk, a monk of no understanding, yet, because he was our brother and of our order, we had to make every allowance. This monk lived a solitary life, as do so many of us, but instead of devoting his time to meditation and contemplation and other things of good, he imagined instead that he was a mighty man in the land of Burma. He imagined that he was not a lowly monk who had hardly set foot upon the path of enlightenment. Instead, in the solitude of his cell, he imagined that he was a great prince, a prince of mighty estates and great wealth. At the start, it was harmless. It was a harmless, if useless, diversion. Certainly no one would have condemned him for a few idle imaginings and yearnings, for, as I say, he had neither the wit nor the learning to really devote himself to the spiritual tasks at hand. This man, throughout the years, whenever he was alone, became the great, great prince. It colored his outlook. It affected his manner. And with the passage of time, the humble monk seemed to disappear, and the arrogant prince came to the fore. At last, the poor, unfortunate man really believed most firmly that he was a prince of the land of Burma. He spoke to an abbot one day as if the abbot was a serf upon the princely estate. The abbot was not such a peaceful abbot as some of us, and I'm sorry to say that the shock which the poor monk turned princeling sustained put him off balance and reduced him to a state of mental instability. But you, Lobsang, have no need to worry about such things. You are stable and well-balanced, and without fear. Remember only these words by way of warning. Fear corrodes the soul. Vain and useless imaginings put one on the wrong path, so that with the passage of years the imaginings become reality, and the realities fade from sight and do not come to light again for several incarnations. Keep your foot upon the path. Let no wild yearnings nor imaginings color or distort your outlook. This is the world of illusion, but to those of us who can face that knowledge, then the illusion can be turned into reality when we are off this world. I thought of all that, and I must confess that I had already heard of that monk-turned-mental prince, because I had read about it in some book in the Lama's library. "Honorable guide," I said, "what are the uses of occult power, then?" The Lama folded his hands and looked straight at me. "The uses of occult knowledge? Well, that's easy enough, Lobsang. We're entitled to help those who are worthy of help. We're not entitled to help those who do not want our help and are not yet ready for help. We do not use occult power or ability for self-gain, nor for hire, nor for reward. The whole purpose of occult power is to speed one's development upwards, to speed one's evolution, and to help the world as a whole, not just the world of humans, but the world of nature, of animals, everything. We were again interrupted by the service, starting in the temple building near us, and as it would have been disrespectful to the gods to continue a discussion while they were being worshipped, we ended our talk and sat in silence by the flickering flame of the butter lamp, now burning low. End of chapter 7.